chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it, come in no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make heaven in the middle of it. Rest make heaven in the middle. We are rest make heaven.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We've got a hell of a lot going on this week. Russia's invaded Ukraine, and we just don't know what exactly is going to come out of all of this. We're going to start off the program with a Greg Reese overview of some of the insightful, you know, comments and data that Greg Reese has about what happened over there in the last 10, 15 years and why the Ukraine is where it's at today. And then we're going to follow that with Jay Dyer. He's going to give us a long overlay, you know, an overview of history of where we're at today. And then I'm going to play a Leo Zagame interview by Harrison Smith, and it tells a little bit more about Putin and his conversion to religion and so forth. But here we go first with Greg Reese.
The first casualty of war is the truth. And if the American people knew the truth about U.S. interference in Ukraine, they might not be so eager to start World War III. During World War II, Western Ukraine sided with the Nazis. After the war, the CIA helped Ukrainian Nazis evade the Nuremberg trials and began operating with them within the Ukraine. After decades of CIA infiltration, the Ukrainian People's Movement emerged in 1989 and gave birth to extremist groups Svoboda, Trident, and Right Sector. Neo-Nazi groups pushing for the ethnic cleansing of Ukraine. Extremist groups cultivated by the CIA, supported by the U.S. State Department, and used by the IMF to bring Ukraine to heel. When Yanukovych beat NATO-backed Yushchenko in the 2010 elections, his government was being pressured into signing an EU association agreement by the International Monetary Fund in their typical conquer-by-debt offer that would financially ruin the Ukraine and place them at the mercy of the World Bank. Yanukovych declined their offer. And in today's corrupt world, you're not allowed to say no to the IMF. Funded by Western NGOs associated with George Soros and the CIA, a highly organized color revolution was immediately deployed against Yanukovych. Organizations such as the National Endowment for Democracy trained activist journalists to utilize Facebook, along with three brand new television networks created within weeks, to recruit people for the protests. This Western-run media campaign was a huge success. The turnout was massive. The CIA has been orchestrating revolutions their entire career, and the first step to their simple formula is to convince people to take to the streets in peaceful protest. They then use agitators to goad the police into violence, and state-run media to ignite the crowd with emotionally charged reports of sacred victims. On November 30th, 2013, the Ukrainian chief of staff, associated closely with the U.S. State Department, ordered the streets to be cleared of protesters for the erection of the annual Christmas tree. When the police arrived, they were met by a highly aggressive and well-organized faction of Ukraine's Right Sector, who provoked the police into a violent reaction against peaceful protesters, which is all the Western intelligence media reported on. Predictably, this resulted in more unrest and violence, which was further fueled by U.S. Senator John McCain's support of the protests. Leaked phone calls reveal that the U.S. State Department was orchestrating this coup d'etat from within the U.S. Embassy, with support from Vice President Joe Biden. On February 20th, unidentified snipers firing from government buildings occupied by the protesters began firing into the crowd, killing people on all sides. Yanukovych's home and offices were taken by armed mobs, and a new government was put into place with a neo-Nazi element that went on to accept the IMF's spurious loan offer and began murdering the Russian-speaking population of Ukraine in Donbass. As a result of this Western-created quagmire, 96% of the people in Crimea voted in favor of joining Russia. And while the nation celebrated, Western media reported that they were invaded by Russia. Their proof? A Russian military presence, which has existed there since 1804. Supporting a criminal war against Russia does not make you a patriot. It makes you a useful idiot of the globalist banking cartel, the very same entities waging war on all of humanity with vaccine passports and experimental jabs. A righteous patriot would call out his government for war crimes. And through fraud and deceit, the United States government has been the world's biggest purveyor of war crimes for decades. All in the name of spreading McDonald's, genetically modified foods, and sexual perversions worldwide. Reporting for InfoWars, this is Greg Reese.
That uprising in 2014, and I think Greg Reese alludes to some snipers that were shooting into the square there, the Maidan Square. And I delved into that a little bit more at that time and uncovered the fact they were on top of the music observatory. Actually, the third story is out on a balcony there. And the snipers that I looked at and got information from videos and so forth, and my analysis indicated they were shooting both sides. They would shoot the government side and then shoot the protest side just to rile everyone up. You talk about evil stuff going on in Ukraine. It's really bad. But anyway, what we're having next is a Jay Dyer overview here of these geopolitical mechanisms, and the British have been at the heart of this. So anyway, listen carefully, and then we'll make a few comments and move on. Here we go, Jay Dyer.
Welcome back to the Alex Jones Show. I'm your guest host, Jay Dyer of Jay's Analysis. You head over to my YouTube channel. You'll notice that I did a recent lecture last night breaking down the wider setting for this Ukraine crisis that's going on. And I want to get into that today, kind of condense that a little bit, because a lot of people don't know the real reason for this, the historical setting for this conflict, and how it ultimately ties into the long-term global elite strategy, the technocratic plan, and the idea of creating, as we said, a Skynet-style one-world government where masses are depopulated. How would this Ukraine situation fit into that? Well, let's get into that. Let's go back a little bit and recall when we discussed in our Tragedy and Hope lectures, right, by Dr. Carol Quigley, the famous historian and archivist for the Council on Foreign Relations, the mentor to Bill Clinton. In Tragedy and Hope, Carol Quigley summarized his 1,300-page tome by saying that the goal of the 20th century for the Western Anglo-American establishment elites was to knock out their two rivals. Those two rivals were the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Russian Empire. And when those two rivals were basically exhausted, depleted, and destroyed from warfare, the Anglo-American establishment could step forward as the preeminent sole world power. Now, this is not the United States. This is the United States co-opted by an inner clique of British Royal Society elites, a.k.a. the Royal Institute for International Affairs, following that Cecil Rhodes, John Ruskin model of a world Fabian socialist government. And so the plan that they had to retake America was to send a bunch of British spies over in the 40s and to get the American establishment on board with the British Empire, the fading, waning British Empire's foreign entanglements and world control. This led to the Pax Americana. The Pax Americana was really, as we said, manufactured or sort of co-op. It was a coup, you could say, on the part of people like Ian Fleming, William Stevenson, on the part of people like Noel Coward to influence the government in the U.S., FDR, et cetera, to get involved in these conflicts. And this leads to not just World War II, but also to the Cold War. And so you can see on the part of the elites of the West, they have a strategy to utilize the engine of America to bring the rest of the world under a kind of global government. Now, when they were promoting this in the last century, right, they promoted it as the idea of a democratic capitalist liberal world order. So we have to go back to the ideology that comes out of the Enlightenment, the classical liberal order, and point out that while there were some good elements in the classical liberal order, the problem is that just like its communist opponent that comes out of that same Enlightenment philosophy, you get two kind of schools of thought, you could say, a revolutionary philosophy that comes out of the French Revolution. You get the Jacobins and you get the Girondins. And both sides of this philosophy are part of a similar dialectic. Not saying that everybody was evil that had the revolutionary philosophy. We know that the American founding fathers definitely had a better approach than the Jacobins, who were very extreme. You know, that led to a radical form of communism that murdered tens of thousands of people in France, for example. But the American order also had a revolutionary impetus. And in my view, it's a mix of ideas. You have good ideas from Christianity, from Mosaic law, biblical law, but you also have a revolutionary impetus as well. So I think in the history of America, you have kind of an internal struggle throughout her history to figure out whether she wants to go in the path of something more Christian or something that's more revolutionary and more controlling. And so where America would go, right, would be dependent upon who would control the country. And in the 20th century, according to Quigley, you have pretty much the rise and complete dominance of America by the oligarchs and the robber barons. And these robber barons and these oligarchs that ended up controlling America, the Rockefellers, the J.P. Morgans, the Carnegies, these families, Vanderbilt, et cetera, they end up aligning themselves with this elite British clique that I'm talking about. And that's why you have the establishment of Pratt House. You have the establishment of Council on Foreign Relations. You have the establishment of Trilateral Commission. All of these are entities mirroring the roundtable groups out of the English clique that we're talking about here. The Lords of London, Lord Curtis, Lord Balfour, Lord Rothschild, Cecil Rhodes, et cetera. They're all aligned with the American Eastern Seaboard elite. And that is what will be the locus of power for the Anglo-American establishment, or sometimes called the Atlanticist power block. And unfortunately, they were successful in winning those two wars and kicking off that Cold War. I'm not saying that the other powers were the good guys and we're the bad guys. I'm saying the reason it's unfortunate is because this is the preparation for a kind of global government that's going to be that we're going into now. This is a 100-plus-year-old plan by these same people. And that's why there's such a powerful continuity of agenda to what we read in people like Bertrand Russell and Lord Birkenhead and H.G. Wells and all these guys writing 120 years ago, right? The exact same plan is coming in right now. So how do we want to situate the Ukraine situation in this global crisis, 20th century world war scenario? If we understand the Cold War as a kind of third world war, then we'll understand the Ukraine scenario, because Ukraine as a crisis comes out of the Cold War. So remember that the imperial model of the West is one that is cloaked as non-imperial, freedom, democracy. It wears a vesture, it wears a cloak, a vestment of human rights and democracy. But in reality, it is a shadow government, as Bernays said. Democracy is always run by a shadow, invisible elite, Bernays said, that is a kind of secret security establishment, a shadow government run by very powerful banking families and industrialist families. And they want to see a technocratic global government that is the Malthusian philosophy from several hundred years ago, right? The Anglican minister Thomas Malthus, who aligned his philosophy with Darwinianism. Darwinian philosophy being not a scientific theory, properly speaking. It has elements of a scientific theory, but it's also a grand narrative philosophy. So uniting that philosophy of Darwinism, materialism and flux and process with the idea of pragmatism from America, you get a pragmatic Anglo-empiricist philosophy. And by empiricism, I just mean pure raw matter and sense data. That's all there is. There's no higher principles. There's no higher things that we are subject to. There's nothing transcendent. It's just matter in motion. And in fact, dialectical materialism, the philosophy of most of the Marxists, or historical materialism of some of the other Marxists, the Soviet bloc, it's another analog. It's just part of that same type of system. So it doesn't matter whether it's capitalist monopoly capitalism based on atheistic dialectical materialism, or whether it's the philosophy of Marxism and collectivism, which is also based on a kind of dialectical materialism and process philosophy. Both of these are flip sides of the same atheistic materialist coin. And Quigley even speaks of this in Tragedy and Hope, where he says that the two world wars and the Cold War aren't just about getting rid of rivals to the West. It's also about getting rid of the ideological clash, the ideological problem that the Western degenerate elites have with any other potential rival system that could emerge that could have any kind of reference to a higher transcendent principle. And so it must of necessity go after and knock out any worldview, any system, any leader that could potentially rise to be a challenge to the radical materialist, atheist, reductionist system of the West. This is really the operating system of the British Empire. This is why so many of the philosophers that came out of the British Empire, David Hume, right, these kinds of people who were radical materialist atheists, really set the stage for the Royal Society's philosophy to dominate in the last several hundred years of academia. This is why Darwinism is taught everywhere in the world without question. Now, many professors do question it, but I'm speaking generally here. So this leads to what we call a postmodern imperialism. The postmodern empire is no longer committed to even the Enlightenment principles of transcendent ideals, of universal notions of rights and justice. It has undercut those as well, because there's no such thing as universal ideas, universal principles. There's no such thing as the abstract truths. There's only will to power. And so the modernist empire, the classical liberal empire, falls and submits to the nihilistic Nietzschean approach, the Übermensch, the will to power. That's why the establishment says and can say competing, contradicting narratives from week to week, because truth is whatever the establishment dictates it is, right? It's not submitting to anything else. Don't go anywhere. We're going to explain this when we come back. Welcome back to the Alex Jones Show. I'm your guest host, Jay Dyer of Jay's Analysis. And I was just talking about my, lecture that I did last night over on YouTube covering the liberal imperium, the clash of ideologies and the preceding ideologies that led us to this present day clash. Now, we were talking about how the Cold War was a kind of dialectic between Western capitalism, or monopoly capitalism, really. It's not really the classical free market capitalism. It's a robber baron monopoly capitalism over against the collectivist view of the, you know, Eurasian communism or collectivism that was actually exported to the West, by the way, as a weapon of cultural warfare and revolution. Now, the exportation of Bolshevism and communism to Russia and to Eurasia was for the purpose of destroying, as we said, those regimes, collectivizing the wealth, transferring it offshore to private banks and so forth as a means of control. And we saw, of course, the same situation with the Cold War. As we said, on the ground, of course, there's a lot of people really fighting this, what Brzezinski called a Manichaean dialectic, right? A managed dialectic between East and West, good guy, bad guy. That was very much hyped up for the purpose, I believe, of erecting what would become the technocracy. So the Cold War allows us to make all these advances, right, in technology, computing, cryptography, that will put in the infrastructure that will lead to the Great Reset, right, the Skynet technocratic order. So the Cold War was one of the stages or the steps towards that long-term goal. And we were talking about the operating system of the West, the philosophy, the ideology that clashes with, in the 20th century, the competing ideologies of postmodern imperialism, atheism, materialism, process philosophy. I know that a lot of people in the West said they believed in God, but the operating system itself was really just atheistic at the top. So Anglo-empiricism, evolutionary philosophy, flux, revolution, that is the operating system that ended up clashing with the two, the rival empires in the 20th century, the Austro-Hungarian and Russia. And so Russia, according to Quigley, had to be stopped because it represents an older operating system of Orthodox Christianity. Now, of course, the last 100 years of revolution in Russia did a lot to damage and destroy the influence of Orthodox Christianity in Russia, and by extension also Orthodoxy in the Ukraine too. Now, the reason that matters is because if Russia emerges out of the Cold War as a power that intends to resurrect or maintain some of that older Orthodox Christian ethos, then it becomes a problem for the West, you see, and for NATO. So the question there is not so much about Putin himself's motives. We can't really know people's motives. It's hard to know that reading all this flurry of media propaganda. But whether Putin's motives are correct or false or whatever, sincere in terms of his promotion of Orthodox Christianity and the symbolism of the Russian Empire and the Tsar and all this kind of stuff, I don't know that. But what I can do is try to judge the objective facts and the way that Brzezinski and people like this, who had a huge role in destroying, bringing down the Soviet Empire, the way he speaks of this and what he said about it. And he said that the Ukraine would be crucial to control because it is a kind of it's the linchpin upon which Russia has to influence Europe. So if you want to cut off Russia to influence Europe away from NATO and away from the U.S., you would have to control the Ukraine. That was Brzezinski's idea. So Brzezinski said, it is crucial then in the Ukraine and all the Soviet bloc countries to peel that away from the influence of Russia and Putin. And so that's what's been going on for the last 30 years. And you just heard that Greg Reese report where he was talking about what I was going to get into, the notion of color revolution. In the early 80s, this began in those Soviet bloc countries as Reagan eventually in the 80s, he moves a lot of intelligence and espionage works out of the domain of military and out of the domain of the CIA and even into privatized groups. So you have a privatized intelligence network that can use cover of things like NGOs and think tanks and foundations. And that's where you get this color revolution model. And at that time, Soros was kind of partnered with the CIA to go and do this stuff in these former Soviet bloc countries. And what they did was soft power, where you influence nation states and existing regimes to be allied with you, right? Through anything that might that could be money, it could be culture. Culture warfare is part of soft power, and that's different or distinct from hard power, right? Warfare. And so the model of using soft power was done for a long time. In the 90s, they were putting money into the Ukraine, what was called the Orange Revolution. That was all engineered by Soros and the National Endowment for Democracy, all these different NGOs and think tanks that were at the behest of or the cover for what the CIA used to do. So you got the Orange Revolution. It didn't really work, but they did finally get their coup in 2014. And so from 2014 to now, you've had many, many thousands of Russians killed in that eastern Ukraine region, right, over this issue and over trying to peel away the Ukraine from Russian influence in the sphere of Russia because it's such a key location. In fact, in World War II, Hitler was very intent on promoting the peeling away of Ukraine. That was a strategy that Hitler used. That's why, partly why, there's so many neo-Nazi-minded people in the Ukraine to this day, and they're still being used right now and funded and aided by the West as a geopolitical chess piece and a tool. And so that's really the context of what's going on. And that's why the provocations and the continual poking of the bear, so to speak, is what led to the reaction of Russia, the ignoring of the of NATO's promise not to expand and so forth. Right. That was all done on intentionally to provoke this conflict. And that's because the idea here is ultimately to get probably Putin bogged down and probably try to wear him out and to destroy Russia. Again, not because we're sitting here trying to figure out whether Putin's a good guy or a bad guy. In geopolitics, it's power relations and objective questions. We can't really figure out everybody's motives, whether they really believe Christianity or not. Regardless, whether it's a tool or whether he really believes it, from the globalist NATO elite perspective, you have to not allow any potential challenger. Brzezinski wrote about this many, many times in his books. No potential challenger can be allowed to arise in Eurasia at all. And so that's why Putin is a problem from the perspective of the Western elites, because any strong man that would arise with any even tenuous connection to the notions of tradition or the notions of authority have to be destroyed. And that's the logic of the appearance of Western democracy and democratic liberalism, is that it must destroy anything like that, because that is a challenge to the logic of the Western liberal neoliberal order, you see. That's what's going on here. It is ultimately a clash of ideological views, and that's why it's not even necessarily about the Ukraine anymore. The same people that supported all the coof stuff have just in 1 week automatically changed over into being supporting the Ukraine. And so it's a global conflict because it's a global clash of rival ideological systems. And that's why in the speech, Putin referenced things like the gender and biological identity attack, right? Because he knows, and the patriarch of the Russian church has said the same thing for the last several years, that the ideological battle, the toxic culture battle that's going on with the promotion of those things is a form of cultural warfare, right? Remember, soft power it also includes that kind of stuff, right? Cutting off peepees, that's part of the cultural toxic warfare. It is an exported warfare ideology. And so that's why it has led to, that's one of the many reasons that has led to this. There's other reasons as well, resources in eastern Ukraine, right? It's a mineral rich, resource rich area. That's another part to play in this. And so it's a battle over ideology ultimately and power, right? All of those things go together. Don't go anywhere. We'll get into this more when we come back. Welcome back to the Alex Jones Show. I'm your guest host, Jay Dyer of Jay's Analysis. We were talking about the Cold War setting and how we got to where we are in this dialectical conflict, and how, according to Brzezinski's model, right, the famous technocratic Cold War strategist that basically set in motion that arc of crisis model where you would destabilize all the Soviet satellites in order to make them amenable to the West. And then you use that NGO model, that soft power model, to prep the people for the eventual regime change that the CIA would manufacture or cause via their human rights NGO cover. And so that's what we've seen really in the last several years with these kinds of conflicts and regime change operations, is that color revolution model. And Brzezinski, of course, pointing out that Ukraine is crucial to the control of Eurasia, right? It's the heartland, and this goes back to Lord Halford Mackinder's British imperial model of the way to control the world is to control the Eurasian heartland. Other people disagree with that. They say, no, it's the Rimland. But regardless, for a lot of the time of World War II and up into the Cold War, the heartland theory of the British Empire also dominated in the Pax Americana. And according to Brzezinski, that's why you have to control on the chessboard the heartland. And so to do this, right, this is what helps contain Russia. But it looks more and more like the global elite due to the potential rise of anything that could suggest a symbolic figure like a Putin or something like this, or Russia or Orthodoxy, as a challenge to Western Anglo-empiricism. It's an empiricist imperialism, if you catch my drift here, in terms of philosophy. Anything that could challenge that has to be neutralized and destroyed, and that's precisely why we've seen in the last 20 years such an anti-Russian hyping up in the media. It's because the Western ethos is now committed to a complete will to power philosophy that evolved out of their universalist notions from the Enlightenment, of universal principles in the Enlightenment and so forth. But if evolutionary philosophy is true and pragmatism are true, then you can see that there's actually no principles that actually exist. Principles are also subject to evolution, and thus the principles evolve to be whatever the power structure says they are. It is a pure will to power. Postmodern imperialism is what we actually have in the West.
I'm going to be giving click off to where Jay Dyer, you can listen to his whole, you could say, lecture on this. But coming up next is Leo Zagami, and he's out of Rome. He's been involved in Freemasonry and Illuminati, and he gives good insights, and he's telling us a little bit more about Putin. But what Putin did initially, with the KGB in East Berlin and so forth, in East Germany, I think Dresden is where he was stationed, were very, very dreadful, very evil things. But anyway, later on, he's saying he got religion, Eastern Orthodox, and he opened up the churches to the Russian people. So anyway, these are interesting things, but what Putin is doing today down in the Ukraine is something else too. So here we go with Leo Zagami.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the American Journal. I'm Harrison Smith. My guest is Leo Zagami. He is an author with 12 published books based on a variety of subjects that range from history of the secret societies in the Vatican to geopolitical matters concerning the New World Order. He possesses intricate knowledge of the inner workings of occult secret societies as well as the Catholic Church. His website is leozagami.com, where you can find his incredible books, including his latest one about the Great Reset and the Great Reject, how we have to undo what has been done to us. Thank you so much for coming on, Leo.
Thank you for having me on. As usual, Harrison, it's always a pleasure.
Well, I felt like I had to have you on. I saw you were on with Alex on Sunday for a little while, and I thought, you know, I got to get Leo on because I remember talking to you a long time ago when you were here in town, and we had a very long conversation. At one point, I asked you about Putin. Because I don't really know what to make of Putin, because on one hand, he's painted as Hitler reborn, as the devil incarnate by the Western powers. On the other hand, you have a lot of people saying that actually he's a champion against the New World Order. He's an Orthodox, Christian that wants to refound the Byzantine Empire. So I don't know what to think about. And I remember you had some really interesting insight into who Putin was and, you know, what sort of drove him. And so I wanted to bring you on and hopefully have you share that with people. So in your opinion, who is Vladimir Putin and what is driving him?
Well, Vladimir Putin is a complex figure because he starts his job in Germany as somebody who was in charge, of course, of Russian Soviet culture in Eastern Germany at that time as a cultural attaché, but in reality he was the head of the KGB there, and of course working with Stasi, which was the feared police from Eastern Germany, this feared secret police. So his history starts there, but then of course, like I explained on Sunday with Alex, he goes through a choice in the 90s. He could have become a typical Russian mafiosi or either join politics and bring Russia on a new course, a new path of hopefully in his eyes also retaliation against the injustices that Russia was suffering after the Soviet Union demise. So it's all about gaining back that old Russian pride that unfortunately, since the end of the Soviet Union, gradually ended. But he is, of course, in this project operating not alone. He's operating with China, a very close ally, and he is, of course, willing to really put us through hell because he thinks that we have basically done so many unjust things against Russia that in the end this is the only way he can finally assert not only the dominance of Russia in his region, but also his sovereignty, because the attempts that George Soros made over the years to dethrone him over and over again have made him more and more angry, especially when NATO also expands in countries that, following the treaties and pacts that were signed after the end of the Soviet Union, should have never entered NATO. So he's a proud Russian. Regarding the Orthodox Church, he also has reconciliated, that was one of the first things really he did, to reconcile his old past as a communist with the Orthodox Church. This operation started as soon as he came into power in 1999 by really encouraging the Russian people to go back to church. So it's a little bit of a different kind of scenario from the Soviet Union, where religion and Christianity were persecuted.
Right.
He understood, thanks to his own relationship with the head of the Orthodox Church, which is currently the Patriarch Kirill, that he could have not only an ally, but he could also project something different outside in the world, not any longer a form of communism which is antithetic to religion, but rather a form of communism that includes religion. Mm. Now, in my latest book that you mentioned, Volume 7, in which I also talk about the involvement of Vladimir Putin in the Great Reset, I explain how the Illuminati, when they built this plan, which is currently taking place worldwide with the Great Reset of Professor Klaus Schwab, when they built this plan originally with Adam Weishaupt, they wanted to actually get the people in the outside, outside of the realms of their order, to believe they were actually Christians, and to believe that Jesus was actually a communist.
Right.
So they gradually worked to promote the assertion that the church had not really sold us the real Christ, and that they were proposing an alternative, which was this communist Jesus that, of course, was very different and antithetic to the church that he himself is said to have founded, which, of course, originally was the Church of Rome. So, with Peter, his disciple, we know though that the Orthodox Church would not, let's say, take on board in the last decade some of the proposals of this new world order. First of all, the digitalization, the digital ID.
Right.
This is something that the Orthodox Church has fiercely opposed, with group prayers, with a constant also, words, very strong words by the leaders of the Orthodox Church, including Kirill, against any possibility that will make man imprisoned by what they define basically as the mark of the beast. And that's what it is, really.
Right.
That's what it is. So,
right. And I think we see that, and of course we've seen Catholic, high level Catholic people, but they sort of are the rebels of the Catholic Church, whereas the Catholic Church itself and the Pope himself seems to be directly in line with this Great Reset, whereas the Orthodox Church seems to recognize this is the mark of the beast and we have to resist that. Is that accurate?
Yeah, the actual Catholic Church is fallen under a false prophet who claims to be a pope, and that is basically what's happening with this Jesuit pope, who is promoting everything that is globalist, everything that, of course, favors the Great Reset plan, which, like I explained in my latest book, was actually born in the Vatican in the last days of the Second Vatican Council by a bishop known as the Red Bishop Camara, who eventually became inspirational for Klaus Schwab. So what is happening here? We have, of course, a pyramid of power worldwide, and we have this alliance between Russia and China, which is very strong. Now, they want to move this American new centrist new world order directly there, towards China, with a Sino-Russian New World Order. And this is, of course, something that the United States will initially resist. But however, if you think about it, at the moment, the United States has managed to get Nord Stream 2 closed, right, which actually favors the United States in a way, because it blocks this important pipeline that will have made Germany further dependent from Russia.
Right.
So recovering also the alliance of NATO through this war and all the rest. So at the moment, actually, it kind of plays in the favor of NATO and the United States, this whole war.
Well, it is interesting, and you've sort of just there previewed so much of what I wanted to talk to you about. So when we get back on the other side, I want to talk about this story. As you just mentioned, CNN has this story: all bets are off if Putin slashes the West oil supply. So this may be coming on the cusp of the shutting down of Nord Stream 2. I also want to talk about, the Catholic Church being involved in China. They said China's the best place for the church to be involved, despite the fact that they're taking down crucifixes and putting up pictures of Xi Jinping in their place. So what that's all about, the way the Catholic Church is playing this, and the cooperation between the secret societies and the intelligence community.
You're listening to The American Journal with your host, Harrison Smith.
Folks, we're going down the rabbit hole with Leo Zagami. LeoZagami.com is where you can go to buy his books, the latest of which is about the Great Reset and how we can reject the Great Reset and fight back against it. It's volume number 7. Of course, the topic on our minds now is Russia, Vladimir Putin, and where this conflict over Ukraine goes. And I do remember, I'm glad you brought this up during the break just now, but tell us about what comes after Ukraine, because you discussed this on Sunday with Alex, and now there has been some confirmation. InfoWars has the story. Has Lukashenko accidentally revealed Moldova will be invaded next? Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko appears to have indicated Vladimir Putin's forces have plans to invade Moldova. And you predicted that, and I remember you predicting that, and here we seem to have some confirmation of that. What's behind this, Leo?
Well, first of all, the fact that Moldova is not a member of NATO. And like I said also on the Alex Jones show, they are like they have been like a widowed country since the end of the Soviet Union. They have been left there on the corners, you know. They haven't been really included in the European Union. They have a profound connection, also culturally speaking, with Russia. And they were doing quite well during the Soviet Union. In fact, during that famous poll that was conducted just before the end of the Soviet Union, the only poll that was conducted by them, Moldova was overwhelmingly in favor of staying, of course, in the Soviet Union. Then suddenly things changed. And that change was not really welcomed by a lot of people that were very proud of their Russian heritage. So I think that that was obviously the next step. It was that they could take is just to go into Moldova. That, of course, puts us, though, in another feared situation, because we have then just next door to Moldova, Romania. And Romania was almost using Moldova as a kind of country that could shield, yes, but also as a country in which they could work their interest that they still have very much with Russia, because people think of Romania as completely philo-European, because integrated in the European Union. But when you actually are, and of course you mentioned the topic of secret societies and Freemasonry, and actually I'm sorry I don't have it here with me now, maybe during the next break I can go and get it. I have a Masonic passport from Romania that I was given by a general of NATO, and I was explained by these people from the lodge that I used to belong in Romania that basically there was a kind of compensation room in which these generals who were closer to Russia will meet with the generals who were instead closer to NATO. So Romania is not really a done deal. They have taken a lot of money. They have become part of the European Union because of economic interest. But there is still a lot of philo-Russians who really also dislike George Soros, because George Soros has a lot of interest and is trying to push himself aggressively in Romania. And, of course, he comes from neighboring Hungary. So we are in a situation that, you understand, could really escalate. And you showed, of course, Alice in Wonderland. I have my own copy that was given to me in 1973. This is like a very... Wow. Oh, wow. The copy, I think it's from like the 50s or 60s. But like we were saying before we went into the break, the church, you were talking about the Catholic Church being controlled in China, and they made a deal in 2018 to make sure that the control was formalized. They receive a lot of money from China, and they started to also persecute Christians in China that opposed this deal with the state. The same can be said in Russia. We can say that agreement between the Orthodox Church and Vladimir Putin made really the Orthodox Church into the official Russian state church. There is no more opposition nowadays like in during the communist times, because there is also a belief that and here you're showing, of course, Vladimir Putin with the Pope, because the Pope has a lot of connections with Russia. He's a Jesuit. The Jesuits were protected by the Empress of Russia during their diaspora. When they were kicked out of the Vatican in the 1770s, they actually ended up in Russia, even if it was Orthodox.
Right.
And the Russian Empire just said to them, we will protect you if you will nominate a Russian general for the Jesuits. A black pope of the Jesuits, that's how he's known, the head of the Jesuits, will have to be Russian. And they indeed gave that possibility to the Jesuits. The Jesuits gave that possibility also to the Russians. And from that moment onwards, there is a link there. Mm-hmm. A link that has never ended, even with the revolution. In fact, Stalin himself was very close to the Jesuits. You showed also the patriarch of Russia, Kirill, who, like we said earlier, is opposing the digitalization process that will lead to the microchipping of the whole population, because in the end that's what's happening here. And in fact, when they started to pass the vaccine passport in Europe, the Orthodox Russian Church opposed that.
Right.
They actually said it clearly. So there is here a veil of contradiction, because we see China as being completely controlling of the Chinese people, and they will not have to even blink an eye if they get tomorrow morning microchip, millions of people just queuing up a microchip, because that's what they do. The Chinese just bow down and work for their state. Russians, though, have a belief that something else is happening here.
Right.
They have a belief that we are in the end times. And so, yes, they want to go back. Putin wants to go back to the Soviet Union. So he wants to regain those borders, which will dangerously bring him also to a confrontation with NATO if he goes moves forward into the Baltic states.
Yeah, I think this is the big question is, is Vladimir Putin and, you know, the New World Order, are they just playing off of each other, but they're going after the same goal?
Let's say this. The New World Order, this is the kind of concept I was discussing yesterday with a friend of mine that you all know, guys, Sean Stone, the son of Oliver Stone.
Yeah.
We were having a chat yesterday morning, and he said, no, the New World Order is only a British-American thing. I said, no, the New World Order is like a car. It's actually like a ship. You can change the crew. Put another flag, and the ship continues going.
Right.
So it's like we need to understand that this is a moment in which the New World Order internal squabble that we are seeing, battle, is favoring both their own plans, which is to eliminate 3/4 of the population of the Earth. They are doing it through the biological warfare, no? That we have seen in the last couple of years with the vaccines. Now they will do it with the war.
Right. It advances all of their plans, the depopulation, the schisming, the destruction of nationality. Absolutely. We'll be back on the other side with more from Leo Zagami. Don't go anywhere, folks. Short commercial break. LeoZagami.com is where you can buy his books. We'll be right back.
We're going to finish off the program with the General Michael Flynn interview recently, and he talks about the border problems, about these wars overseas and so forth, but a very generic, generalized way. But anyway, when we hear the music, you'll know that we're ending the program. So just going to play all I can of this interview, and then I'm going to give you a click off. We can find the whole thing. So here we go with this General Flynn interview.
The CBP, the Border Patrol organization that we have that protects our borders, is broken. They're not close to being broken. They're not, you know, they're not at the edge. They're broken. So we've seen a lot of these military age males being put onto airplanes and flying around, sort of low level, flying around and being dropped off all over the country, all over the country. So why? And we have to answer that question. And we have to ask our elected officials, why are you allowing this to happen? And the only thing that I can, the only answer that I have right now from, again, from the reminder that I was given yesterday, is that to me, This is a purposeful, intentional process to destroy this country. There's no other answer that I have.
Okay, we are at the We Stand America conference or meeting, rally, whatever you want to call it. And it was important to be here at the border because of the irony of the situation with what we have with the president. You want to explain that?
Yeah, so we're in McAllen, Texas, and we're holding a rally here. Yesterday, a small group of us did a tour of a couple of border locations, and we were briefed by not only former senior Border Patrol and ICE and Homeland Security officials, very senior, the individuals actually who ran those organizations, CBP and ICE, but also current members of the CBP that gave us a overview of what's happening at the border. And a lot of things happened. I mean, I don't know if you were present there, but because I know there was some other media. But the one thing that I learned, that I take away, not just that we got people crossing the border at a just a maddening rate. We're north of about 3 million, I think, now from 151 countries. But the statement that I heard yesterday that I take away is that the CBP, the Border Patrol organization that we have that protects our borders, is broken. They're not close to being broken. They're not, you know, they're not at the edge. They're broken. And just so happened overnight, I know one of the I was sent this morning a video. I think it's out there going viral on the Internet right now, where a CBP senior member, 31 years, and he's very public about how he feels. And he's talking to, I think, in the audience at that location. In the audience was the head of the CBP. And we have to stop kidding ourselves that this problem here on the southern border of the United States, whether it's Texas or New Mexico, Arizona, and California, is affecting all 50 states. All 50 states. You know, certainly the contiguous 48 that we have here, people from Oklahoma that I know, people from Kansas, Montana, up in New England that I speak to all the time, the fentanyl problem, the methamphetamine problem, the cocaine problem, the marijuana problem, the crime rising, the assault on our police forces, the abuse of women and the abuse of children. I mean, just the stunning stories that I was told yesterday. I don't think that what we are seeing, to me, it's not a surprise, because I've been aware of this for certainly the last 20, if not the last 40 years. I mean, I was assigned, so from a personal part of my life, I was assigned to Fort Huachuca, Arizona, which is a beautiful Army base, and it's right on the border. And over the years that I was assigned there, we always had illegals coming in, you know, through the military reservation. You know, the last time I was assigned there, we had upwards of 10,000 a month. That was 20 years ago. 20 years ago. So that's just in one path coming across the border, and that's in Arizona. So here we are in Texas, and we know the staggering numbers that our federal government is not doing anything about it. In fact, they're allowing it to happen, and they're, you know, we just saw the breaking news in the last 96 hours where we're seeing some of these mostly military, I call them military age males, you know, on the battlefields in Iraq and Afghanistan. We call them MAMs, M-A-M, military age males. So we've seen a lot of these military age males being put onto airplanes and flying around, sort of low level, flying around and being dropped off all over the country. So why? You have to ask, you know, we can't keep saying we got to stop this. Now you have to say, for any of your audience, and I don't know what your audience is, but we have to start asking the question, why? And we have to answer that question. And we have to ask our elected officials, why are you allowing this to happen? And the only answer that I have right now from the reminder that I was given yesterday is that, to me, this is purposeful, intentional process to destroy this country. There's no other answer that I have. I mean, why would you want to have rising crime rates? Why would you want to have millions of illegals? Why would you want to have 151 countries? One of the data points, I think, was 30 of those countries are from what we call high-risk countries, meaning that the people that are coming in from some of these countries are unknown. There's no vetting going on. There's no vetting. When they say, oh, we're vetting, and the government gives you some answer, it's like the answers they're giving you about COVID and vaccines. I mean, it's all fake. It's what we've learned, right? So now what we're learning again about illegal immigration, you know, and all the noise going on about Eastern Europe and the Ukraine and Taiwan, and all these things that are happening, these are distractions to me for the bigger, broader issue of taking total control of this country. That's the only way I say it. So, you know, they're going to tell me, Christy, your audience and people that will see this, because they're watching. Believe me, you'll have more than just your audience watching this. You know, they'll go, oh, conspiracy theory, you know, right wing. No, I was born and raised a Democrat. People, if you really looked at me, if you want to sit down and survey me about what I believe in, I'll probably be left of center. And I was raised in a family that believed in this country, which is where I think most Democrats are. But the Democratic Party, if you haven't woken up yet, they're Democrats, is being stolen. And it's being stolen by a socialist movement in this country. We can't kid ourselves anymore.
Well, the other attack on this is they like to paint it as a picture of there's a lack of compassion, that these people are coming here for a better life.
No.
But the thing is it really compassionate when we are watching these women and these children crossing the border, which I personally did, and we know that these women and these children, they're being basically sold into slavery. So there's that end, too. There is compassion. We don't want them to be trafficked.
Yeah. So you're going to have all these words and phrases that are used against people like me, people like you, maybe others who are in this business of trying to raise the awareness of what it is that we're happening. So the story that I was told yesterday, and this is really it's brutal, but it's honest. I mean, I'm relaying, you know, from someone who spoke to the woman who was illegally coming across the border, and she was with a bunch of young girls, and she was the mother of one of the young girls, and so she was brutally raped while she had to lay on top of the girls because she was protecting them. And then, and she her basically her her message, I guess, to these psychopaths, you know, was, you know, take me, don't take these young girls. And she's laying on top. I mean, so that story was told to me yesterday. So I mean, that's, there's no compassion for this. I mean, for that kind of, like, you know, I mean, for the people that go, well, you don't have any compassion. You know, this, you're a racist. You're whatever. I mean, when I think about that, and I think about all of those things that are happening, because we all know that this is happening. We all know that there's a massive, massive child abuse, massive sex trafficking, massive human trafficking. And we almost use those words like they're easy to roll off of our tongue, right? And it's sick. It's sick. So how do we deal with it? We just allow them to pour in, and then all these other things that attack our healthcare system, attack our financial system, attack our jobs. I mean, all these things. So what's one of the answers? Because that's the problem, right? What's one of the answers? Maybe we fix our legal immigration system. Maybe it takes too long. I mean, the legal immigrants that I have spoken to from all over the world, whether they're from China or whether they're from Eastern Europe or whether they're from Africa, those that have come in legally have always described a process that they actually respected. Mm-hmm. So maybe we can tighten that up a little bit. But to just go open border policy, right? Open borders. I mean, we just have an open world. You're going to have massive problems, and we're going to be dealing with these problems, you know. And now, is
it? Yet the administration cares about the border at Ukraine and Russia.
Yeah. So, you know, again, it gets back to this business about, well, you have no compassion. You're a racist. You're, you know, you don't want these brown people coming in. And I don't care if people are pink with purple polka dots, you know.